Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With me now is Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor Ruth Marcus. She has described the Trump impeachment process as Kavanaugh 2.0, and she's in a good position to make that comparison. Ruth has a new book called Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. So we'll talk about the comparison between that and impeachment. We'll talk about Nancy Pelosi's announcement this morning. Maybe we'll follow up on our last segment about Kamala Harris getting out of the race. And a spoiler alert with respect to the book. On page 364, Ruth writes that Christine Blasey Ford's father and Brett Kavanaugh's father are golf buddies, and Ralph Blasey emailed Ed Kavanaugh the day after the final vote to say he was glad Brett had been confirmed. Ruth, great to have you back. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wait, what? Did Ralph Blasey really say that to Ed Kavanaugh?
He really did. And there had been a discussion throughout the confirmation hearings after Christine Blasey Ford's allegations became public about where her family was. And the truth is that one of the reasons she had been so reluctant to come public and to expose was that she was worried about exposing her family, not just her family back home in California where she lives, but her parents and her brothers who still live here in the Washington area. She's got nieces and nephews as well. She did not want to expose them to public scrutiny because she knew they lived in a very small, insular, almost tribal community. And behind the scenes, I have to say, her parents were supportive of her testimony. They came, I described this in the book, coming to visit her at the Watergate Hotel where she was holed up with her team in the aftermath of that testimony. Her father told her that he was proud of her, but there is this just ineluctable fact of the email that he sent to Ed Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh's father, the morning after the confirmation, saying that he was glad that Brett Kavanaugh, whom his daughter had accused of trying to sexually assault her, had been confirmed. And that is just a painful fact that I unearthed and needed to report in this book.
Are you the person who revealed that email to Dr. Ford, or did she already know?
I am not clear on the state of knowledge. I had been asking about it. I've been hearing about it for months and asking about it for months. But I do know that I would not have. This is such a painful moment that if I was not 100% certain that it was true, I would not have included it in the book. I would not have included anything in the book that I wasn't 100% certain was true. Mm-hmm. But I knew this one was so powerful. I wanted to be especially careful about it.
How much of a price do you think Dr. Ford has been paying to this day?
I think that's a really important question, and the answer is quite a bit. This is not a person who ever sought the limelight. In my hours of conversation with her, she talked about how it was even difficult for her to get up in front of her class of students at the beginning of the term in California when she was teaching them statistics because she does not like performing in public. And she did have, she talked about this quite passionately, this combined sense of civic duty that she felt like she had information that senators should hear, and an incredible naivete, I would say, particularly for somebody who grew up in the confines of Washington, D.C., about how she thought she would be able to bring this information to the attention of the White House, to the attention of the senators, and have it handled in a private way it exploded. She became a recognizable public figure. It was not for 3 months that she was able to move back into her own home, and she's had to engage in intensive security measures. And so there's been both a physical toll on her and her family, and probably even greater an emotional toll.
You argue in the book that the Democrats were ineffective and unwilling to engage in the kinds of no-holds-barred partisan warfare that the Republicans engage in. What else could they have done in the Kavanaugh fight, in your opinion?
Well, I write in the book that the Democrats had a bad hand and they proceeded to play it badly. The bad hand was one they had some role in dealing themselves, which was prior to the Kavanaugh nomination, every nominee previously had faced the requirement, at least in theory, of having to obtain 60 votes because there was the possibility that the nominee could be filibustered. In the Gorsuch nomination, in the angry aftermath of the Republicans having effectively stolen the seat that Merrick Garland was nominated for, the Scalia seat, Democrats played their hand and decided that the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees that had already been eliminated for lower court nominees, it was going to be removed no matter what. And so they were going to force Republicans to go nuclear and remove the filibuster in the Gorsuch nomination. I think that was a mistake because, though many people disagree, imagine a world in which the filibuster had remained for, they had not filibustered Gorsuch, they allowed him to be confirmed. The filibuster was then in place when Justice Kavanaugh was nominated, and the Christine Blasey Ford allegations were roiling the country. In that context, would Susan Collins, Senator from Maine, would Lisa Murkowski, would other institutionalist Republicans in the Senate have been willing to undo the filibuster? Institutional Republicans being willing to undo the filibuster? I think not. So bad playing field. And then the really inescapable fact of the matter is that and I write about this extensively in the book, and I try to do it with some care and sensitivity. The lead Democrat in charge of the hearings was Dianne Feinstein, the oldest member of the Senate. She lived in a sort of older bipartisan kind of bygone world of the Senate. And honestly, she was not the fierce advocate that she once was. And I think she was not the right captain for an all-out fight. And I think the way she handled the Christine Blasey Ford allegations, which were very difficult to handle because Christine Ford reasonably asked for a confidentiality, but Dianne Feinstein sat on those allegations, didn't even let the senior members of her leadership know the decision that she was making. I think that also did not help this bad hand that the Senate Democrats started with.
You mentioned Susan Collins. Let me play a clip of her from just after the confirmation, or just as she was announcing that she was going to vote for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, in which she pretty much predicted that based on her contact with him, that he would uphold Roe versus Wade if he winds up voting on it. Listen.
In his testimony, he noted repeatedly that Roe had been upheld by Planned Parenthood versus Casey, describing it as precedent on precedent. When I asked him, would it be sufficient to overturn a long-established precedent if five current justices believed that it was wrongly decided, he emphatically said no.
So, Ruth Marcus, what do you think about that? Do you think that Brett Kavanaugh kind of promised the world, or Susan Collins via the hearings, or however you might want to put it, that he's going to vote to uphold Roe?
Well, it depends on what the meaning of uphold Roe is. I think Brett Kavanaugh recited to Susan Collins all of the reasons, important reasons, that he, like other justices, would be reluctant to overturn precedent. But we will see. My prediction is that certainly with five votes on the court, a five-justice conservative majority, the court would be very reluctant to outright overrule Roe. But I think that that's not really the most important question. The question is, what are these five conservative justices? And they could be joined by a sixth. And if they're joined by a sixth, they're joined by a seventh. I think Roe itself could fall. But even before that, in fact, this very term, we are going to have an abortion case at the Supreme Court, a case that involves an abortion restriction that is almost identical to an abortion restriction that the court with Justice Kennedy, who Justice Kavanaugh replaced, provided the fifth vote for to strike down the restriction. Now, an identical one is back at the Supreme Court again. I think it will be very interesting and very telling to see whether Justice Kavanaugh votes the same way that Justice Kennedy did to strike down that law, or whether, as I think is more likely, he'll vote to uphold it. And then I think it will be really interesting to hear from Susan Collins about how she feels about her vote.
My guest is Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor Ruth Marcus. Her new book is Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. In a minute, we'll see why she calls impeachment Kavanaugh 2.0. We also have some breaking impeachment news to bring you right after this break. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor Ruth Marcus. Her new book is Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. We can take some phone calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Ruth, a New York Times review of your book says the most interesting part is your discussion of why, in the end, the evidence mattered so little. Do you think evidence mattered little?
I do. I think that we are at this moment in our politics where votes can be almost perfectly predicted based on political party. Votes on judges, votes now on impeachment or conviction of President Trump in the proceedings that we're watching. And that is, we tend to forget, it hasn't always been like that. If you look back to the Bork nomination, which was the opening salvo in the 30 years of judicial nominations wars that I talk about in Supreme Ambition, a number of Republicans, six Republicans, voted against then-Judge Bork, not to confirm him. Two Democrats switched party lines and voted to confirm him. It wasn't this automatic just resort to this is what my side believes. And I think we see both in the Kavanaugh confirmation and in the impeachment hearings that we're going through now, not a desire to grapple with the fundamental facts, but to argue about motive. Democrats were out to get Brett Kavanaugh from the start, and this only came up at the last minute, so we can't be bothered to deal with it. Democrats were out to impeach President Trump from before he was even sworn into office, and their Russia hoax fizzled. I'm quoting the Republican line in case any listeners think that I'm endorsing this view. And so, therefore, we can't deal with the very serious reality of the Ukraine episode. In both cases, it's this reflexive tribalism that wants to pretend that the motives of critics undermine the seriousness of the allegations that a responsible Congress, and in the case of Justice Kavanaugh, a responsible Senate that has advice and consent responsibility under the Constitution would have been pursuing.
That's the heart of your argument, that impeachment is Kavanaugh 2.0?
Yes, and that we're talking about motive instead of facts, that we just go to our corners in this tribalism. And, you know, there's a little bit of fair both sides do it in this situation. I write in the book that actually I thought before the Christine Blasey Ford allegations arose that Justice Kavanaugh, who I've known for a long time, since he worked for Ken Starr, amazingly, was a pretty credible, well-qualified, run-of-the-mill Republican nominee. within the mainstream of conservative judicial thought, that was not the way Democrats looked at it. Almost every Democrat was intending to vote against him from the start. So tribalism goes both ways.
You did write a column recently that in a way was similar to the argument that the Republicans' law professor witness Jonathan Turley made yesterday, that the investigation should go deeper. What's your version of that?
Well, there's a real conundrum that the Democrats are in, and because that we're watching this obstruction of Congress in plain sight and continuing every day, it's like an article of impeachment that occurs anew with every morning and every day that we don't get testimony from really critical people like John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, like the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, like the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. And I think that Democrats are in a serious bind, and I am much more sympathetic. Well, I differ from Professor Turley on two grounds. One is I think that there is ample evidence to impeach this president based on what we know now. And second, while I think it is really just shameful that President Trump has been blocking access to this important testimony, I am empathetic with Democrats' understandable eye on the clock, and in particular on the electoral clock, because it is true that the closer we get to an election, the less imperative it is to remove the president from office. And so I think that you can't, it's like the orphan who goes to the judge and asks for mercy. You can't argue that we're not ready to impeach or convict President Trump because he has blocked us from getting information. So I would actually call myself the non-Turley in this debate.
Could it be that in an alternative way of looking at that, that the Democrats should be less concerned with rushing impeachment to its conclusion, which is almost certain defeat in the Senate before election season, and more concerned with pushing in the courts for John Bolton and Pompeo and everyone to testify and showing the world the full plot wherever and whenever the chips may land?
Well, I'm still, to be completely honest, up in the air and ambivalent about this, which is not usually the position that I find myself in. The reality is that we have not had definitive court rulings on these sorts of issues because in a better and more normal world, the two co-equal branches find accommodations with each other. We've only really pushed this to the Supreme Court level in the Nixon tapes case. One risk that Democrats would have pushing this in the courts is the possibility of losing. But even if they are willing to take that risk, the delay that would occur, I think, even if we think we know what the ultimate outcome here is going to be on impeachment and conviction, I think that the facts involving the president are serious enough that the House is really kind of constitutionally bound, morally bound by the oath to the Constitution to do what it's doing and to pursue these impeachment inquiries. And I also wish that they could simultaneously find a way to pursue impeachment and to aggressively pursue the additional evidence that I'm really convinced they're entitled to.
Ruth Marcus, our guest, Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor, and now the author of the book, Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. And as you've been hearing, she describes the impeachment process as Kavanaugh 2.0 for a variety of reasons. Let me get you on some breaking news this morning, Ruth. First, I'm sure you heard Nancy Pelosi announce that she is now officially asking the Judiciary Committee to draw up articles of impeachment. And just over the wires in the last few minutes here, the Judiciary Committee announces that it will hold a hearing on Monday, next hearing coming Monday, to receive lawyer presentations of evidence in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump from the Intelligence Committee.
And so we now see the kind of stately minuet proceeding that we know was going to happen really from the moment when the impeachment inquiry was formally launched, what feels like a long time ago, but was only a few weeks ago. I think one of the most interesting questions to watch in the next week is going to involve the scope of those articles of impeachment. It is possible to draw them narrowly, focusing on Ukraine and focusing on this continuing obstruction that I've talked about. It is possible to draw them more broadly. My personal instinct is that Ukraine is different. As outrageous and concerning and impeachable some of the president's previous conduct has been, in particular, the obstruction of justice type activities that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, identified in his report, that Ukraine is different, not in kind, really, but in degree. For me, it moved impeachment from can do to must do. And I think that Democrats would probably be better off as a political matter and also as a legal matter. In other words, making their case to the public and then making their case to the Senate, such as it is willing to consider it. Mm-hmm. On a more take your best evidence, take your strongest evidence, and run with that. Though this completely one of those reasonable minds can differ on this. And just if you don't include the broader questions of the president's conduct in the articles themselves, I don't think that means anybody has to be ignorant of it or try to put them out of your mind. You can kind of take judicial and popular and senatorial notice of all the other things that the president has done.
I want to play a clip. I don't know if you've heard this yet, of about a minute and a half from just after Speaker Pelosi announced that she's asking actual articles of impeachment to be drawn up this morning. This is a minute and a half clip, and it starts with a reporter asking as she's walking off, do you hate the president? Listen.
Do you hate the president, Madam Speaker? Because
I asked a question.
Representative Collins yesterday suggested that the Democrats are doing this simply because they don't like the guy.
I have nothing to do with it.
I think it's an important point.
I think the president is a coward when it comes to helping our kids who are afraid of gun violence. I think he is cruel when he doesn't deal with helping our dreamers, of which we're very proud. I think he's in denial about the climate crisis. However, that's about the election. This is about the election. Take it up in the election. This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is a heart full of love and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
Speaker Pelosi spontaneously returning to the podium after announcing that she's ordering articles of impeachment to be drawn up after being questioned if she hates the president. Ruth, that exchange is blowing up our Twitter. I don't know if it's blowing up yours as well. But did you hear it previously? Do you know who the reporter is? And what's your reaction?
I am wow, but I'm not surprised that the speaker responded to the word hate, because that is a kind of trigger word for her, because when she talks about her Catholicism and her view of grace and forgiveness and praying for the president, I think that is a significant part of who she is. I think in some ways, and some people may disagree with that, that she hates finding herself in these impeachment proceedings. She did not want to be here. She resisted the leftward precincts of her caucus and her party for months as they pushed and pushed and pushed to launching these impeachment proceedings. I think she is worried about the political consequences of them. And I think While you can tell, and she has not been shy about saying that she is no fan of the president, I think she is no fan of having to go through this impeachment proceeding because it's not necessarily good for her politics down the road. And so I think that is a piece of the explanation of why she responded so sharply.
The subtitle of your book is Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Where does the Kavanaugh part fit into the conservative takeover part?
So conservatives have been for 30 plus years trying without success, foiled by the defeat of Judge Bork, foiled by the choice of Justice Kennedy, who was a conservative but not a totally solid one, foiled by the selection of Justice Souter, who turned out to be a liberal, in assembling a solid and reliable conservative majority. Brett Kavanaugh was their opportunity, finally, after all this time, to have a 5-justice conservative majority on the court. And that was his ambition was to get there, and their ambition was to get there as well. And when he ran into trouble with the allegations of Christine Blasey Ford and others, they were going to do whatever it took to get him across the finish line, because this was the end of a 30-year effort on their part. And by the time Kavanaugh's nomination ran into trouble, he was, as one of the chief lawyers on the Republican side told me, too big to fail. They weren't going to allow him to fail. They needed 50 votes. And my book tells really the inside story of what they did in order to get there.
Are the two parties not equivalent, in your opinion, in this respect? Democratic presidents appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor, et cetera. Is it not simply that Democratic presidents appoint liberal justices and fight for them, and Republican presidents appoint conservatives and fight for them, and that's just the power of the presidency and of the electorate?
The two parties aren't equivalent in two different ways. One is that Republican presidents, with the exceptions that they now rue and that have been used as cautionary tales of what not to do in the future, Republican presidents, both on the lower courts and at the Supreme Court, have been much more focused on ideology and making sure that the conservative judicial philosophy was going to be represented on the courts, plural. Democratic presidents have been focused on a bunch of things. They include diversity, racial diversity, gender diversity, and less focused on the ideology. People don't remember, but at the time that Justice Ginsburg was nominated, there was concern from the left that she was too moderate.
Pete Buttigieg has floated an idea in his campaign of increasing the court to 15 justices, as you know, but also he says that would make it less partisan by having 5 of the justices appointed by the other 10, not by the president. Do you have an opinion about that idea?
I really am not a fan of all sorts of shenanigans to remake the courts, whether to pack them that way or to pack them in other ways that increase them. The one change that I would make and that I think would be extremely useful would be to institute 18-year terms for justices. That would make this less a matter of winning the lottery, where one president could get 4 nominations. President Trump likes to say, I think I'm going to get 5, and one president could get 0. So that would regularize things more. I think 15 justices is way too many, and having them pick their colleagues is a crazy notion, and it's never going to happen. I would say one last thing about the previous question you asked about whether Republicans or Democrats are better at this. Outside of presidents, I think that the architecture of support for Republican nominees and Democratic nominees is really asymmetric. After Bork was defeated, Republicans basically decided never again, and because they had been outmaneuvered and outgunned by Democrats on that. And so they built up, through the Federalist Society and associated groups, the architecture and the financial structure to make certain that they were going to get their nominees in place and confirmed. And Democrats have not been able to match in any way close that process in the years since Bork.
Ruth Marcus, Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor, and now the author of Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Ruth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And nowadays, basically every young person on the planet can tell their story on a global platform as long as they have a phone and a Twitter account. That wasn't the case when the beloved WNYC program Radio Rookies first started 20 years ago. If you're a WNYC listener, you've probably heard it. Radio Rookies provides teenagers with the tools and training to create radio stories about themselves, their communities, and their world. The show covers everything from drug abuse, getting through high school, gentrification, love, loss, family, and joy. It's so cool because it's made by teenagers themselves. An upcoming episode comes from rookie Aram Sin, whose story is about whether she can hold on to her Senegalese identity when Americans just want to see her as black, and learning about her own blackness in the context of America. With me now is Aram Sin, and with her is Verilyn Williams, a producer on Radio Rookies, who first got her start as a subject of an episode in 2005 when she was 17. You can figure out her age now. We'll hear some of that too. So welcome to WNYC, Aram.
Thank you.
And hi, Verilyn.
Hi, Brian.
Congratulations on 20 years of Rookies.
God, yes, thank you. Thank you.
14 years involving you, first as a rookie and eventually as a staffer. Mm-hmm. So I want to dive right into Aram's story so we can invite some calls from people with maybe similar experiences. But since we're also celebrating the 20th anniversary of Rookies, Verilyn, give our listeners and some who may not be familiar with the series a sense. How do you go about finding subjects for stories, finding the rookies, and how did you come across Aram?
Well, we went to her school, and typically we partner with a school or a community organizing group or something within one of the boroughs in New York City, and we recruit. We ask teenagers what is a story that they can tell uniquely well, like what's a story that they have access to that, you know, any reporter coming to their neighborhood or their school or whatever the case might be wouldn't be able to tell. And so similarly, we found Aram. and she, we've been working on your story for over a year. So the rookie process could be anywhere from 6 months to a year. And Aram's story, because of the nature of wanting to document her evolution to having a racial identity in this country, took a little bit longer than most.
And Aram, I'm going to let part of your story speak for you first. This is 43 seconds.
Growing up, I never thought about race. But that changed when I moved to the U.S. 2 years ago.
Did you think about race when you were in Senegal?
No, not at all.
Because in Senegal, like, we are all black, so yeah. Uh-huh.
I am in the lunchroom at my school, talking with my friends.
So when did you realize that you were black, actually?
When we came here, when I moved to New York City. Like, seeing in this paper, black, African, American, white, Hispanic, something like that.
She's talking about the college application form.
At that time, I realized that I'm black.
It is weird having to check the box black/African-American. African is not an option.
And we're going to play one more clip here first in another moment in the piece where Aram talks to her friend Crystal Hawes, and she asks why Crystal describes herself as, quote, regular black. Here's what Crystal had to say.
That's a good question. People always ask, well, where are you from? And when I say here, it always goes back to like, well, where are your parents from? And I say here, like literally here. And then it goes back and back and back until I can't identify specifically where the here is anymore. So I say just black or regular black to mean like black American, even though at some point I'm obviously African. I don't know what point, and I don't have people to point me in the direction. So it's like something was taken from me. I am missing a thing. And I would ask you, like, do you identify as black now? Would you say you're black or you're African? Or when would you use it? And when would you not use it?
I am still confused. I don't know where to fit. Because my skin color is black. Mm-hmm. But then I'm African because I'm from Africa. Mm-hmm. So society is not giving me the choice. So I'm just black, I guess.
the voice of Aram Sin, one of our latest radio rookies here at WNYC, from the piece that she just produced. Aram sounds great. And let me ask you, before this piece, how much had you talked to American-born black people about blackness, and was it a comfortable experience? Any sort of conversation about identity, I know, can be hard.
Before this program or before the tape?
Well, the interview. Before you became a radio rookie.
I never had this conversation before, but I wanted to talk about it with black Americans, but like, I didn't have enough courage to do it or where to start, and I didn't know how they would react to it.
But you had the thoughts, obviously, in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, Verilyn, how does Radio Rookies take someone like Aram from step one, having the thought, having the desire to have this kind of conversation, and giving her, well, she said, the courage as well as the skills to do it?
I think it was interesting because I remember the first time when we started talking, we started talking about her analysis or her even understanding about black, not identifying as black. And so for me, as someone that is, I was born in Sierra Leone, but came here as a baby. And so I present as black American. Culturally, I'm American. And so I remember that first conversation. So at Ricky's, we want Aram to have a journey. And so it was just interesting because I was just like, I didn't want to put my, obviously, analysis from being here my whole life onto her. And so it was about letting her truly come to an understanding for herself. So in the beginning, it was a lot of, I don't know, I think you had taken or you were reading, what was the book you were reading? Something Convict or? I forget, she was reading something that was like someone that was incarcerated for a long time or in jail.
Oh, yeah, a letter to, I don't remember.
Yeah, but she was reading a book about an experience of someone that was wrongfully convicted or was in jail. Yeah. And that's, for me, it's okay, I know exactly how to deconstruct what's going on here. And I just remember feeling like I need to slow down and really get her to get there. So that's a lot of what we do.
Aram, how old were you when you came here?
I was 18.
Oh, so that's really different than coming as a baby.
As a baby, yeah.
So,
but similar in the sense that, a lot of what Aram was talking about as far as the things she heard from her uncles, one of the lines is, don't behave like black Americans or, they will bring you down. Growing up, I heard that growing up. I heard, go to school, behave yourself, don't behave like those black Americans. And even at that time, I knew, something about this is really messed up. And even at Thanksgiving, because of, working on Aram's story and a lot of the stuff that's been in the news now around the ADOS movement, American Descendants of Slaves, my family, we talk about this stuff all the time.
And listeners, anybody want to chime in with a similar story? Are you an immigrant who didn't realize you were black, as Aram put it, until you came to America? And what made you realize? Was there an exact moment or more like a gradual thing? And like Aram, are you frustrated with the limited terms, black or African-American? Do you see them as limited like she does? What do those things signify to you? What do they leave out? This year the Census Bureau announced that African-Americans will be able to list their origins on census forms for the first time, instead of simply checking the word black, a box next to the word black. So will you be writing in something different on next year's census than maybe you did in 2010? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's play another clip from Aram's Radio Rookie story, in which she talks specifically about tensions between African-born kids at school and black American-born kids. Here's a clip.
So, you guys said that you were afraid of them, African-American people. So, where does this fear come from?
Outside, you will see some kind of people, like some black people in the train. You see them, the way they act, like they don't want anybody to touch them. They are so, how to say it? Yeah, right. Man, right.
I'm a little ashamed, but before moving here, friends and uncles taught me, don't interact with black Americans. They will influence you to do bad things. And when I got here, I quickly realized the stereotypes, they go both ways.
Aha. So do you want to talk about that last thought, how stereotypes go both ways?
Yes, it's like Black Americans, they see us as not uneducated, but we speak broken English, for example. So we're not as smart as they are, or we are dirty or something like that. We just lower than them. And us, we see them as dangerous. Like, we shouldn't interact with them. We should stay away from them. But at the end of the day, we're all the same. So I don't know where the stereotypes come from.
And at the end of your piece, you describe trying to confront your friends about stereotyping Black Americans. Here's a minute of that.
I decided to confront my friends. Can you tell me, please, what's the difference between us Africans and Black Americans?
Like, you can see from them that they are rude, but not us.
It was a hard conversation to have on tape. If you take a step back, we are not different. We are not different. Maybe we have different backgrounds. I wanted them to be more open-minded. So, did you guys watch When They See Us? And to put themselves in the shoes of Black Americans. They didn't do anything. That's what I'm saying.
It's because they are Black.
It's because they are Black. So, what I'm trying to say is that someone can have some type of behavior, but you don't know their background. You don't know what they have been through.
One day, my friends and I were on the train talking, and an older white lady screamed at us. She said we were too loud. And I was so mad that just speaking, existing, was disturbing her. I felt restricted. Imagine feeling that for generations. That would be too much.
You're really striking a chord out there, Aram, judging by our phones. Desiree in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Desiree.
Hi, Brian. I'm first generation American. Both of my parents are from Barbados. And I think I only realized that I was considered Black when I went to school, because my parents are from a majority Black country. So it's nothing that's talked about regularly, more so these days because we're becoming more global. But back then, it wasn't really talked about. It wasn't looked on anyway or anything like that. And it's only when I went to a predominantly white school and the kids are pointing out the fact that I'm a different color than them that I realize that. And then I go home and I want explanations from my parents as why are they saying these things to me. You know, as far as the census goes, I'm very excited about the fact that I'll be able to be more specific about who I am and where I'm from, because normally with classification boxes, I don't check African American because I don't consider myself African American, because I can't consider that someone whose family is in generations passes from here. I will check Black because I'm of course Black. If they don't have Caribbean American, I will check other if they don't have Black.
Desiree, thank you so much. And this is going beyond Black listeners. Gustavo in Brooklyn also identifies with your story, Aram. Gustavo, you're on WNYC.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to mention that that happens with other races as well, because I came here about 33 years ago, and I'm from Argentina, and I became aware of race when I had to fill out forms. In Argentina, when I lived there, nobody ever asked me, what race are you of? And here, you know, I had to check a box, and I didn't know what to put. In Argentina, most people are white, and do I put Latino as in Central American or Mexican, or do I put Latino as Caribbean, or do I put white? What do I put? Mm-hmm. You know, nobody ever asked me, so it was weird. Thank you.
Thank you, Gustavo. One more. Stephen in Woodside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephen.
Oh, my God, Brian, I'm a big fan. I listen to you every day. I moved here 2 years ago. I'm 32 years old. When I moved in, now I'm 34. I never understood what Black was. I grew up in Nigeria, went to college, worked for 5 years before moving over with my wife and daughter, only to realize that I was a different color from other people. I liked the Americans. Everybody is my friend. But I seem to have tensions with people who were born here, African-Americans. I expected them to be closer. So I find that my friends are more European, white-looking and all that. They're even more interested in my story than the African-Americans are.
Oh boy.
And I don't know why that is the case. And I find that there are tensions. People are not really open to you. When you go to the subways, nobody wants to talk to you. I'm like, hey, I'm right here. So Steve, it's kind of difficult.
Thank you for your call. Verlin, what are you thinking? I mean, these are some difficult thoughts, you know, where he's saying he feels more accepted by white people than black people. Mm-hmm. You must be cringing a little bit to hear this kind of division creeping into this conversation, even mm-hmm. though it's about difference among black people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm cringing, but I'm also so used. I mean, it's like every day. I do, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is like, what is the cause of this? And, you know, American media, American culture is exported around the world. And unfortunately, the way that black people in America is depicted on most of the things that we watch and see in the music is in a negative light. And so when you are an immigrant that comes here for a quote-unquote better life, you're wanting to separate yourself. I think Kai Wright, one of the hosts here, he says, like, you know, when you are marginalized, the way that some people deal with being marginalized is to have someone under them. And so whether you're an African immigrant, you don't want to be like the black Americans. And if you're a black American, you don't want to be like the foreigner, the immigrant, you know. And so I think right now the thing that's giving me the most inspiration is just thinking about social media right now, like the fact that, you know, you can follow, quote unquote, you know, hashtag black love, black, you know, black lives matter. You can follow hashtags that, you know, can give you images that are not generated by mainstream media. It's like what Aram and her friends are doing, and that is black.
We're going to run out of time really soon. I know, Verlin, there are some resources on the Radio Workies website that you want to mention, mm-hmm. like a lesson plan for teachers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a lesson plan that is based on the different stories that we've done, so that way you can hear a story like Aram's story and really think about what are the themes, what are the lessons, like how, like writing, for instance. Like, I think Aram was very surprised by how much mm-hmm. writing goes into making a radio piece, or even just asking questions. I think like the power of the microphone to be able to hold it up and get people to answer your questions is a powerful thing to give a teenager right now. And in a way that is not, you know, is amplified and it could be used for a purpose.
You mean people write in radio before they just talk?
Yes, Ryan.
I am shocked to discover this. So Aram, what do you want to do in the United States as a grown up?
I'm going to school right now. And I wish to be a doctor. I am majoring in biology. And yeah, maybe I'll minor in black studies too, because I'm really interested.
Yes.
Well, congratulations on a wonderful piece, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Verlin, congratulations on 20 years of Radio Rookies. Unbelievable.
Yes, Brian. Thank you. Thank you for always giving us a platform to come on.
It's always one of the best segments that we do. I think we had a great example of it today with all the callers that you inspired to open up about things they've experienced. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and yes, now it's time for our annual call-in that we call Shop Listener. Your chance, if you're a Brian Lehrer Show listener and you have a small business that sells holiday gifts, to get a little free boost from us against the big box stores and the online behemoth that we will call Behemoth. If you sell holiday gifts, we'll invite you to tell everyone right now how to Shop Listener for your stuff. Brian Lehrer Show listener, 212-433-9692. Not surprisingly, our lines are already full. So listeners, this also goes on Twitter. So use the hashtag ShopListener if you want to post something. And we can refer all our listeners by me saying it just right now like this. All our listeners to our Twitter feed to see things that are posted with hashtag ShopListener. Obviously, by the way, shoppers, anything that you hear on the radio or see on Twitter, you know, you might want to do a little vetting. But we think our Brian Lehrer Show listeners who sell things that are holiday gifts deserve a lot of love and deserve this little extra boost. So here we go. ShopListener, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, starting with Ann in Hoboken. Ann, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Laird. It's great to talk to you.
What do you sell?
I have had a boutique here in Hoboken for 24 years. Myself and my staff sell contemporary designers for clothing, jewelry, accessories, all kinds of women's wares for women that want to look, you know, unique and unusual and buy from small designers.
How's business these days, given all the pressures we always talk about?
Business is good. It's very tricky. It's always changing. It's important that I'm here every day to hear my customers and change with them, but it's okay. We're still here, and I still love it.
Pepper and Parlor, right?
Yeah, Pepper with one P, P-E-P-E-R, and Parlor. And we're here in Hoboken on Washington Street near 10th, and we also have a website, which is most of our collection, not everything. So the experience is really being in the store.
And thanks for calling. Happy holidays. Good luck.
Thank you.
And Ruth in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Brian. I am a big fan of yours. I'm so happy to be on.
Glad you're on.
I am a local New York City beekeeper, and we set up shop at Bryant Park and Columbus Circle this time of year. And we sell little honey bears. They're 2 ounces, and they all wear a little Santa hat. They all have different messages on the labels. We have over 100 different labels, such as Merry Christmas, honey, I love you, honey, you're so sweet, honey, love you to the moon and back, honey, Happy Hanukkah, honey, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And we also are purveyors of high-quality, pure honey from different beekeepers from around the states.
How many bees do you keep in Queens?
I actually have a total of about 10 hives between Queens and Staten Island. We help pollinate a 2-acre farm in Snug Harbor Botanical Garden, and the other hives are in the backyard in Douglaston, and there are a couple at Fort Totten at Bayside on the property of Bayside Historical Society.
Uh-huh. So honey grams with a Z?
Yes.
And people can get them online, or you got to go to Bryant Park?
You can get online, honeygrams.com, or you can just come and see us. Visit us on 40th Street in Bryant Park or at Columbus Circle.
Thanks, Ruth. Good luck out there. And Ray in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. I've called in a couple times, and every time I get on your show, I get customers. So I appreciate you doing this for me.
Great. And remind me what you do, what you sell.
I have a company, Harlem Built, that is mostly custom-made, high-quality, fine furniture. We do have some holiday gifts that are available on our website, harlembuilt.com, like some wine racks and some jewelry boxes and stuff like that. But in the past, from your show, I've gotten some customers that have forgone the holiday gifts and ordered tables and chairs and dressers and other stuff from us. So we appreciate any business that comes our way.
So Harlem Built. Good luck out there, Ray. Kelly in Eatontown. You're on WNYC. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I see you have something really different.
We are the owners of Stumpy's Hatchet House. We're in Eatontown, New Jersey for the flagship location, but we have other locations that are closer to the city, Upper Saddle River, Fairfield, Greenbrook, and we have something coming in Brooklyn in the spring. But we are promoting giving the gift of experience this year. So gift cards to give people to go out and have a good time throwing hatchets and drinking some beer and just letting loose.
And those are always some of the best gift ideas that we have that people are selling on Shop Listener every year. It's the experiences, not just the physical things. So tell me how this works again. Maybe I should know this, but you go to a bar and you drink and you throw axes at something?
Well, it's actually not a bar. We have a couple of our locations have beer and wine for sale, but most of them are BYOB. So if you look at the website, all the different locations have the particulars. So our website's stumpyshh.com, and you go in, you make a reservation, and usually it's a 1 or 2 hour session coming with friends, and you throw hatchets and you have a good time and you do something that you just kind of let loose and relieve some stress and do something really social.
Stumpy's Hatchet House, Stumpy's HH. Kelly, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And you can buy an online gift card in our e-commerce store.
Awesome. Mike in Darien, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Really appreciate it.
Sure. What you got?
So I am a co-owner of a business called Charlie's Chaga, Soda and Tea of the Woods, and we make delicious teas and sodas out of healing mushrooms like chaga mushrooms and turkey tails and reishis and cordyceps. And all our ingredients are organic and sustainably sourced, which is very rare for chaga. It's very hard to find. And they are cancer fighting, super antioxidant drinks, and they're delicious. So I encourage everybody, if they can, to go to chagasoda.com or Greeb's Pharmacy in Darien, Connecticut. We have our whole line of products. And it's a really unique product. You know, the only one company of its kind out there. So it's a little different, but chagasoda.com is our site.
And all mushroom based is what you're saying.
Yes, sir. So turkey tail mushroom, which is a really well-known one. And then we have ones like the chaga mushroom, which is actually called king of the mushrooms because it's packed with melanin, antioxidants, all sorts of good stuff that can kind of help you get your New Year's resolution started early. So that's kind of what we're pushing. So, and they make really good gifts. They're fun. You can make teas yourself, flavor them yourself with all different things, or you can get our prepackaged flavor bags like chai satchels or mint hibiscus satchels, or our soda, which is really good and uses all natural organic ingredients. So no high fructose corn syrup or white sugar or anything like that.
That's a mushroom flavored carbonated drink?
It is a cola flavored soda. Chaga has no real fungal flavor to it. I encourage you and everybody to take Google deep dive on it. It's really interesting, and there's a reason they call it King of the Mushrooms.
All right.
It's really good for you. So,
Charlie's Chaga, Chaga?
Yes, sir.
Mike, thanks a lot. Good luck out there. Lauren in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So, my best friend and I have a very small new business. It's called Broadway Ducks, D-U-C-K-S. And we actually take little rubber ducks, white rubber ducks, like the kind that you would find in like a little claw machine, and using crafts and Sharpies and clay and whatnot, we take these ducks and we transform them into Broadway characters. We also do TV show characters, movie characters, the whole nine yards. And it started pretty much as just a way to give back to the actors on Broadway because we are huge, huge supporters of the arts. And then people started asking if they could buy them. So we opened up an Etsy shop. It's etsy.com/shop/Broadway Ducks. And we take custom orders. Everything is made to order, shipped out, and made special for you.
So when you say rubber ducks as like Broadway and TV characters, it's, you know, Rachel Brosnahan, Midge Maisel as a Broadway duck? Or like, give me an example.
We could do Midge Maisel 100%. We've done Glee characters for people. We've done like Eponine from Les Mis or Beetlejuice from the Broadway show Beetlejuice. We just take the photos, those professional photos that they get or a specific photo that somebody gives to us. And using that, we just create them.
I see. They're custom and you can take requests and then make them.
Exactly.
Do you do political figures? Are people asking?
You know what? People have not asked. We probably could if they asked.
It's probably the relief that they're asking for, right? And then could you ask? I shouldn't go down this rabbit hole, but could you ask for a political figure and then make it a more or less flattering image? more flattering or less flattering? You know what I mean?
I mean, we definitely could if you asked. Yes.
All right. I don't know if I started a whole new stream of your business there. I probably hope not. But there you go. Broadway Ducks on Etsy, right?
Yes.
Lauren, good luck.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Sarah on the North Fork of Long Island. Hi, Sarah. You're on WNYC on Shop Listener.
Hi. Delighted. I founded Vote Like a Mother. And it was based on the sign that I made, just hand-lettered with a Sharpie for the March for Our Lives in 2018. I was so inspired by the teen survivors. And I thought about what is this issue come down to the issue of gun violence in America. And I was just spitballing, you know, vote them out. Vote like your life depends on it. Vote like a mother. And I thought, well, I like the double meaning. And I took it in, and Upper West Side, we're on the subway, and people were crossing the subway cart to come take a photo of my sign. And I knew that I had something that was resonating with people. So this whole idea came to me. I got on the subway Wi-Fi, grabbed the URL, votelikeamother.org, grabbed the social media handles, and ever since have been making this gear and donating 100% on T-shirts, all sustainably and ethically made, tote bags, hats and buttons and magnets for your fridge or your car, all sorts of stuff. And it's really been about catalyzing conversations, multi-generational, kind of encouraging, you know, teenagers gifting parents and grandparents stuff and starting conversations around what does it mean to view politics through a lens of parenthood.
So vote like a mother.
Yeah.
Online for Vote Like a Mother gear. Sarah, thank you so much. Good luck with it. And Jane in the East Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What you got?
So we have a little store, my husband and I, in the East Village, and we've had it for 40 years, and we import things from India. I go there myself, and I work with a women's empowerment project, and we help educate children in the small village, and we also have a sewing project for women, and I carry those products in our store, and our prices run from $1 up, so we're very affordable. And our hours are 4 p.m. till about 9 p.m. And our phone number is 212-677-7897.
Jane, thanks a lot. Good luck this season. George in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Sure. What's up?
We have a website. It's called flagcollars.com, FLAGCOLLARS.com. And we sell dog collars and leashes mostly that are actually designed after flags from all over the world. And I mean, every single country that you can possibly think of. We're also USMC licensed. So we do U.S. Marines dog collars and leashes. We do thin blue line. We do thin red line. And we've been doing it since 2006, so we're not a new company.
All right. Thank you very much, Flag Collars. By the way, Jane, the previous caller from the East Village, described her store, and she gave the phone number, but she never actually said the name of the store. So it is Kapinka, K-A-P-I-N-K-A, on 9th Street in the East Village. Todd in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Todd. What you got?
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Okay.
I'm a denim specialist. I have a studio full of old sewing machines. They're factory-grade sewing machines. I do alterations. I do repairs. And I do custom jeans and jackets. I'm in Bushwick. And you can find me on Instagram at Todd Martin Studio.
Awesome. And I think we have time for one more. Inga in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Inga.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What you got? Real quick.
We're a small business, a children's store in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We're a small store, but we've got a big space. And we've been here from 2007. We're a mom-and-pop store. My husband and I are in the store every day.
And what's the name? Because I'm going to run out of time.
Minnie Jake.
Minnie Jake. In Williamsburg.
Yes, it's 178 North 9th Street.
Thank you very much. And thanks to all of you who called Shop Listener for this year's edition. We tried to get it in nice and early this year, in plenty of time for people to shop your stuff before Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa. As usual, very creative things, gift ideas that you might not hear of anywhere else. The Hatchet Bar, the custom celebrity rubber ducks, Vote Like a Mother, all of it. And we can continue it online. Listeners, if you want an opportunity to get your holiday gifts from other Brian Lehrer Show listeners, if you're selling the gifts, just use the hashtag ShopListener on Twitter. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.